Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio on the 23rd of July, 2016. I'm Hereward Fenton. Glad to have you listening today, and I'm very pleased to be able to bring you a show. I've been off the air for a few weeks. Had a few personal matters to attend to, but I intend to get right back into the coverage of important issues and the analysis of important issues. Today's show is a radio-only show, but I will be getting back into the video format starting again from next week. And we'll be bringing you some interesting interviews and hopefully some group discussions over the next few months. Now, today I want to begin with looking at Donald Trump's nomination speech from the 21st of July. Of course, this is a major turning point. Everyone knew that Donald Trump would be nominated, but the fact that it's now happened and the speeches that were given do indicate some important trends, some important things to consider with the possibility of a Trump presidency of the United States. Now, I've been moderately supportive of Donald Trump since about beginning of this year, and I've looked at a lot of different positions that he's taken. I've considered it from different angles, and I've come to the conclusion that Donald Trump is someone that is certainly original, certainly breaks the mold of the type of politician that we've seen in the past, particularly the type of politician that rises to the level of the highest office, that he's incredibly a spontaneous person. And these are very, very different qualities to what we have seen before. What is also clear from everything that Donald Trump has projected is that he does not, he's not the sort of man who is simply a puppet or is simply controlled by the elites, the ruling elites, the financial oligarchy, the people who have been pulling the strings in America for generations, if not hundreds of years. And it's remarkable that that he has come so far. Of course, he's very powerful, very rich. But again, there have been a lot of powerful, rich people who've attempted to do what he's done and have not succeeded. What stands out, of course, is that he represents something about national sovereignty that has been absent in American political rhetoric for a very long time. And the issues that he's so strong on, which many in the left find so offensive, for example, about building a wall to stop the illegal immigrants, to put a brake on immigration from countries that have been associated with terrorism, to impose import tariffs, to boost internal revenue. These are all sovereignty-building political policies that differentiate the United States from other countries. Whereas what we've seen in the past and what is the bedrock of the left's policies has always been that everything has to open up. And of course, this was also the case with the Bush regime and with the both Bush, the son and the father, that the United States has to open up and that there is an incentive for economic growth to have less trade regulation, to have more openness. And the concept of openness has been seen as a positive thing. But of course, with that concept of openness has come the erosion of sovereignty. And that erosion of sovereignty has gone hand in hand with rampant militarism. It's odd in a way, isn't it? But these two things have gone together, because it's as if the United States, in sort of becoming more open, less restrictive in terms of its national sovereignty, has also become much more aggressive and brutal as an empire builder. And one could argue that the reason for this is that those very powerful financial elites who've been pulling the strings basically are trying to consolidate their power worldwide. And the United States has been a springboard for them, but is not necessarily their main allegiance. Even though many of them are Americans, many of them are not. Even though most of the wealth is concentrated in America, those who own that wealth see themselves as a shadow government on a higher level. And this is where I think Donald Trump is actually engaging with those forces. And I mean that in a militaristic sense. He's engaging. He's going into battle against those forces who are seeking to expand a kind of umbrella of power that, while it may have begun with the United States, is going to kind of shed that at some point and is going to become a kind of global regime, a new world order. And this is something that I do believe Donald Trump recognizes, and something that he is working against. But that does not mean he will succeed, and that does not let him off the hook in other ways. And actually, today I want to have a little look at some of the things he said in the speech that he gave for his nomination, where he's concentrating on law and order issues. Because now, I'm really not absolutely sure what is going on here. Because on one level, he's responding in a way which is genuine, and it is reflective of how many, many people feel about what's happening in America. But on another level, there is a dark side to what he's proposing. And I'm not saying he's going to go down that dark route, but it's a route that others have gone down in the name of law and order. And of course, we saw it most starkly after the events of September 11, 2001, when a massive new push for law and order, both within the United States and globally, took place, you know, to deal with the threat of terrorism. And wave upon wave of legislation was passed in the US and many other countries to deal with this threat, to supposedly make people safe. And in this speech that Donald Trump gave, he repeatedly uses the phrase that he's going to make people safe. And this honestly sends chills up my spine, because I know what that has meant in the past. I know what that has gone along with. It has gone along with the massive proliferation of government power, new laws that allow government to invade people's privacy, to infringe on people's basic civil rights, to basically roll back so many of the inherent protections that are enshrined in the US Constitution and in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, universal principles such as, you know, the right to a trial, the right to representation, freedom of speech, freedom of movement. So if Donald Trump's speech signifies that his presidency is going to move along that route that we saw with the Bush presidency, then I think there's a cause for concern, indeed, cause for alarm. And I really don't know what the truth is on that. We won't know. You could certainly argue that what he's doing now is just a continuance of his populist style by appealing to issues that are of great concern to many ordinary people, many of the bedrock of his own support, the terrorist attacks, the attacks on police that we've seen, and that he's saying, you know, he's going to restore law and order. He's also saying he's going to kind of restore the dignity of the United States. But again, those words, that type of rhetoric, has a dark connotation. And many leaders in the past have used that as a cue to basically bring in all forms of brutal dictatorships. So what is going to happen with Donald Trump? We don't know. But what, as I said, what I sense, what many people have picked up on, is that he does have this angle in his entire background, in the way he has brought his policies to the public, the way he has argued what he believes in, that there is something a bit more deep going on, that there is something here that is appealing to an awareness that the people of the United States have not had a genuine representative government, that people have been allowed into power that have used the position of power corruptly and have led the US down a disintegrating path. And he has been critical of the nation-building exercises and the sort of empire-building that we've seen with the last 20, 30, 40 years of United States hegemony around the world. So that's the positive side of it. When we come back, I'm going to play a little from the speech and just give a little more analysis of that. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking a little about Donald Trump today. Of course, the big news being the nomination, the Republican National Convention, some very powerful, stirring speeches given by both Donald Trump and his children. I've watched the speech given by his daughter. It was incredibly powerful. And I watched a little of the speech given by his son. Obviously, a family of high achievers, a family of people who are very articulate, very well educated, and there is certainly a feeling created from listening to the Trump speak that if he becomes president, that it's almost like a new dynasty. You know, it's a bit like the Kennedys. It's a feeling of Camelot that basically a new dynasty of power may be opening up within the highest echelons of United States politics. But I just want to address this law and order question now, because that was a big theme of the speech that he gave on the 21st of July. So I'm just going to play a little of it to you and maybe pause to make a few comments. Here we go.
These are the facts. Decades of progress made in bringing down crime are now being reversed by this administration's rollback of criminal enforcement. Homicides last year increased by 17% in America's 50 largest cities. That's the largest increase in 25 years. In our nation's capitals, killings have risen by 50%. They're up nearly 60% in nearby Baltimore. In the president's hometown of Chicago, more than 2,000 people have been the victim of shootings this year alone, and almost 4,000 have been killed in the Chicago area since he took office. The number of police officers killed in the line of duty has risen by almost 50% compared to this point last year. Nearly 180,000 illegal immigrants with criminal records ordered deported from our country are tonight roaming free to threaten peaceful citizens. The number of new illegal immigrant families who have crossed the border so far this year already exceeds the entire total from 2015. They are being released by the tens of thousands into our communities with no regard for the impact on public safety or resources. One such border crosser was released and made his way to Nebraska. There, he ended the life of an innocent young girl named Sarah Root. She was 21 years old and was killed the day after graduating from college with a 4.0 grade point average, number one in her class.
Okay, I'll just pause it there. Obviously, he's conflating, in a sense, the problem with illegal immigration, the violence that might be flowing from the influx of illegal immigrants over the border, with a general problem of crime in the US generally, and, of course, at a later point, he brings up the attacks on police, which have been quite dramatic in the last month or so. Now, the problem here is that while all that is true, what he doesn't raise, what he doesn't mention, is the United States already has this massive apparatus of control, surveillance, you know, crime fusion centers, greater powers than they've ever had, you know, in previous decades, you know, increasing power to detain people, increasing legislation to allow them to be able to do things that might have not been feasible before. So there has already been this incredible build-up of law and order. And so what it has led to? What has it led to? It's led to increased violence. It's been part of a problem of increased violence. And of course, what he doesn't mention in his speech is the massive problem with police violence against ordinary, harmless citizens. And this is why it's a little worrying to me, because he's up on this law and order rant. And, you know, one of the biggest problems with law and order in the United States is the abuse of power from those who are supposed to be administering the law. So I'll just continue with the speech, perhaps skip through it to some more important parts, but I'll just keep going for now. Here we go.
The first task for our new administration will be to liberate our citizens from the crime and terrorism and lawlessness that threatens our communities. America was shocked to its core when our police officers in Dallas were so brutally executed. Immediately after Dallas, we've seen continued threats and violence against our law enforcement officials. Law officers have been shot or killed in recent days in Georgia, Missouri, Wisconsin, Kansas, Michigan, and Tennessee. On Sunday, more police were gunned down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Three were killed, and three were very, very badly injured. An attack on law enforcement is an attack on all Americans. I have a message to every last person threatening the peace on our streets and the safety of our police. When I take the oath of office next year, I will restore law and order to our country. Believe me, believe me. I will work with and appoint the best and brightest prosecutors and law enforcement officials to get the job properly done. In this race for the White House, I am the law and order candidate.
So there we have it. Donald Trump is the law and order candidate. Now, this could mean one of two things. It could mean exactly as it sounds, and it could be that he is simply going to work to restore the rule of law, in which case he would be needing to address both sides of the equation: abuses of power from within government and police, as well as all the lawlessness that we see on the streets and from terrorists, etc. But the other possibility is that he's going to go down the path that we've seen so many times before, which is basically the path of tyranny. Only time will tell. We're going to break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Moving on now to some other stories, I want to talk a little bit about the concept of copyright infringement in the wake of a story that popped up on Torrent Freak. The owner of a website called Kick Ass Torrents has been arrested. The 30-year-old Ukrainian was arrested in Poland on the 20th of July and is charged with criminal copyright infringement and money laundering. In addition, a federal court in Chicago has ordered the seizure of several Kick-Ass Torrents domain names. With millions of unique visitors per day, Kick-Ass Torrents has become the most used torrent site on the internet, beating even the Pirate Bay. Today, however, the site has run into a significant roadblock after US authorities announced the arrest of the site's alleged owner. The 30-year-old Artem Vaulin from Ukraine was arrested in Poland, from where the United States has requested his extradition. In a criminal complaint filed in the US District Court in Chicago, the alleged owner is charged with conspiracy to commit criminal copyright infringement, conspiracy to commit money laundering, and two counts of criminal copyright infringement. The complaint further reveals that the feds posed as an advertiser, which revealed a bank account associated with the site. Now, it appears from my reading of this that the main case against him is based on the fact that he was selling advertising on his website. And, of course, this was providing a revenue stream. And this was indeed how he was caught, because the authorities ran a sting operation on him, posing as advertisers. So I'm not totally clear on the specifics of the legal case here, but I think that the fact that that revenue was being obtained from selling advertising would be the core of the criminal complaint. But I mean, let's just consider this in context of what is actually really going on with torrents and with file sharing generally. When you download a torrent that you found from a site like Kick-Ass Torrents or the Pirate Bay, all that's happened is that you've run a search on their system to find seeds that have been uploaded, that have been shared by people that are on the peer-to-peer network. And of course, the reason why they come up in Pirate Bay or that they come up in Kick-Ass Torrents is because the people who are sharing those torrents are members of that website, and they have their own page on the website. And it's a community, right? And they're sharing files, and they're able to it's a social activity as much as anything else. But because of the vast numbers of people who are doing this, the data that's on sites like the Pirate Bay becomes like a vast index, a database to find anything that you're looking for. But in reality, it's just a community of people who've shared files together. And it has been difficult within the framework of law to prosecute these types of operations. Although, you know, it has been done, but it has also failed many times. And indeed, we see the Pirate Bay still running despite the arrest and imprisonment of the founder of the Pirate Bay. And the core of it, and the reason why it's not just a straight, you know, slam dunk case of, you know, let's lock up these people who are just criminals, is because What's going on here is that people are sharing digital copies of information. There is no theft going on, ladies and gentlemen. There is no victim. There is no perpetrator. For there to be a victim, there has to be someone who's been deprived of something. You know, if you're walking down the street and someone picks your pocket and steals your wallet, then that's something that you had before that you don't have now. And that is theft, and that is part of the common law definition of theft, and it's very easy to understand. But imagine if someone had a device. Imagine if there was some new technology that came out, nanotechnology, let's say, that allowed a person to quietly make a complete 100% reproduction of your wallet sitting in your back pocket with some little handheld device, to basically clone it and give themselves their own copy. So you don't lose any money. You've still got all your information. You've still got your credit cards. But they've got a complete copy of everything you have. Now, of course, that would raise interesting legal problems, wouldn't it? But to simply say that's theft, which is the kind of the approach that's been used in trying to crack down on copyright infringement, is ridiculous. It's not theft. You're not taking something away. In the same sense that imagine on your street, in your suburb, imagine there's a Thai restaurant on one side of the street and they make a range of dishes that you like and you go there and you eat there. And then one day, another Thai restaurant opens up across the road. And guess what? They're selling the same range of dishes. And because there's now two restaurants, well, there's now a second choice that you have. There's competition. So you might go to the other restaurant. So that first restaurant loses some revenue. Now, when copyright owners complain that they're losing revenue as a result of copyright infringement, that's the type of situation. That's a very accurate analogy to what's going on. It's simply competition. And nothing's been taken away. Nothing's been stolen from them. But of course, and I hear you say, and I hear many people say, no, but you know, these people have stolen the copyrighted information. No, they haven't. They haven't stolen anything. We see with digital technology, it is possible to make a perfect copy. So that is not the same as stealing. You cannot call it stealing. It is a perfect copy. Now, of course, you can enact statutes. You can pass legislation to say anything. You can pass legislation to say that the moon is made of green cheese if you want. That doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it's correct. So when you pass legislation to say that that merely making a digital copy of something is some kind of crime, well, of course, that has been done and it has been put into statutes. But in most cases, it's only a civil penalty, not a criminal penalty. Because lawmakers have been forced to engage with the fact that this is not quite the same as picking someone's pocket. Despite the rhetoric, despite the way they talk about it, it is not the same. And the more advanced thinkers, the people who understand technology and understand where we're headed, have proposed that we need to completely reevaluate this whole way of thinking. And to understand that the ability to digitally copy content is with us, it is not going away, it is available, it's free, it's available to anyone on the planet who's got access to a computer, and you simply cannot criminalize that type of behavior. It is just outrageous and unacceptable to criminalize that type of behavior. But you still can have a legal framework that goes some way to protecting the rights of content creators. And I support some of that, right? When we come back from the break, I'll go through what I see as being reasonable aspects of a legal framework and what are unreasonable. With Truth News Radio Australia, it is really great to be talking to you today. I'll be right back after this very short advertising break.
happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm talking a little about copyright infringement today in the wake of this big story about the owner of Kick-Ass Torrents being arrested in Poland. And I just wanted to raise the whole question of copyright law and to go into some of the questions about it that I think a lot of people are not aware of, some of the history of it that people are not aware of. I mean, look, I support some protections for content creators. And there are ways of doing this that are reasonable and that do not criminalise totally innocent behaviour. What it centres on is people profiting from material that was copied and or claiming it to be their own and repackaging it and then selling it. And there are plenty of ways of restricting that because sale of goods has to go through various checks and balances and it can be tracked, right? Whereas, you know, simply copying and sharing files, which is done by billions of people around the world, is something that's it's unreasonable to track. It's an invasion of privacy on the one hand, and it's unreasonable to demonize because, as I've said, it's a simple, free thing that technology simply provides. You can't call that something criminal. It's just it's totally unacceptable to make that criminal. But if someone were to download a copy of a film, package it, put it on a DVD and try to sell it, I think that there is a reason to have that, have some penalties for that. I still think, you know, criminal penalties are way over the top, right, to make it criminal. It is a civil matter and it should always only remain a civil matter. But there should be some redress there. There should be some way of using the law courts to get financial remuneration from people who are doing that. Now, in the case of Kick-Ass Torrents, they weren't doing that, but what they were doing was selling advertising on a website. But selling advertising on a website that was merely a website of members who get together to share files, right? So again, that's really stretching your definition of profiting from copyright violation. Like, the way I see it is that this is just a competitive service. And the best way for the big content owners to deal with that is to develop a better competing service. They don't want to do that. You see, they want to take the easy path. They want to just use laws. They want to just control people and suppress people because they think they've got the governments in their pockets, right? I mean, we already know that digital material can be copied and shared freely and easily, right? So accept that that's a reality, right? Don't try and fight the people who are doing it and don't try and fight people who've set up a site to help people do that. Set up your own site and make it free, or maybe charge a very small amount for quality assurance purposes, right? Because most torrent downloaders want to know they're getting something that's going to be reasonable quality, right? And they will pay a small amount of money, but it's got to be a very small amount. And this is the key thing, is that the big copyright owners are still charging way too much. It can't be a dollar a song. It has to be like 5 cents a song. And if it's 5 cents a song, you'll start to get the market and they'll still make massive amounts of money, but they're just charging too much. And this applies to Apple, iTunes, as well as all of the other services out there that are providing streaming services. They're all ripping people off. You know, it's just they're making money out of nothing, basically, because they're doing nothing. They're just making digital copies of stuff, right? And the amount of return they're getting on it is idiotically huge. Now, I just want to go over some very important historical facts about copyright, because what a lot of people don't understand about copyright is that from the beginning, copyright law has been a form of tyranny exerted by elites over ordinary people. And we tend to think that copyright law is about protecting the rights of individuals and content creators, that's the way it's packaged to us, the way it's sold to us. But from the beginning, it was about securing the power of ruling elites, which is threatened by the free dissemination of information generally. And we're not just talking about songs and movies. We're talking about all kinds of information. And I'm just reading to you here from a Wikipedia article on the topic. In Europe, printing was invented and widely established in the 15th and 16th centuries. While governments and church encouraged printing in many ways, which allowed the dissemination of Bibles and government information, works of dissent and criticism could also circulate rapidly. As a consequence, governments established controls over printers across Europe, requiring them to have official licenses to trade and produce books. The licenses typically gave printers the exclusive right to print particular works for a fixed period of years and enabled the printer to prevent others from printing the same work during that period. As the menace of printing spread, governments established centralized control mechanisms. And in 1557, the English Crown thought to stem the flow of seditious and heretical books by chartering the Stationers' Company. The right to print was limited to the members of that guild, and 30 years later, the Star Chamber was chartered to curtail the great enormities and abuses of diverse, contentious, and disorderly persons professing the art or mystery of printing or selling of books. The right to print was restricted to two universities and to the 21 existing printers in the City of London, which had 53 printing presses. The French Crown also repressed printing, and printer Étienne Dolé was burned at the stake in 1546. As the English took control of type founding in 1637, printers fled to the Netherlands. Confrontation with authority made printers radical and rebellious, and 800 authors, printers and book dealers were incarcerated in the Bastille before it was stormed in 1789. The notion that the expression of dissent or subversive views should be tolerated, not censured or punished, by law, developed alongside the rise of printing and the press. And that is the most important thing to take from what I've just said, which is that the biggest threat that printing ever posed to anybody was the threat to the power of the ruling elites, because it allowed people to communicate information, to disseminate dissenting material on any topic, to get people thinking, to share ideas, right? And this is what ruling elites are always trying to suppress. They don't want people to get together and share ideas. Now, problem is, of course, under our democratic framework of law, you can't say that that's wrong. You can't demonize that directly. So this concept of copyright was invented. And in the old days, you know, it was less euphemistic. It was a bit more obvious what they were on about. But over the centuries, it became delicately overlaid with a more acceptable social meaning, so that instead of being about people being banned from using printing presses, if they, you know, if they hadn't had the stamp of approval of the king and the government, right, of the day, it became, no, you're not allowed to print certain things because you might be violating someone's copyright in printing things. Now, of course, a lot of the objections to the freedom of information were overridden. And of course, we did see in the 19th century massive social revolution everywhere, largely because of the dissemination of books like, you know, Karl Marx's Manifesto, various documents like that, which could get into the hands of millions of people and could change history. But what's happened in the last few decades, and let's say predominantly from the rise of the internet, is now an attempt to use copyright law as a way of restricting freedom of communication generally. And that's something that's going to have to be a topic for another show. But the type of legislation that they're using against kick-ass torrents and other alleged copyright infringers can and will be used to chill free speech generally, because, of course, in today's world, everything is about sharing information. Everything that you have to say involves sharing something someone else has said, if only just to comment on it, and because it's important, because it's in the news. So on the one hand, we've got the philosophical question, the issue of whether what they call copyright infringement is even morally wrong to start off with. Secondly, we've got the problem of, is there some legitimate way of limiting people's ability to profit from selling copied material? But thirdly, and to me the most important thing, is whether a framework of laws is being developed that will ultimately be used to suppress the kind of communication that you're hearing today on this show. That's our show for this week. I will be back next week. It's been excellent talking to you. See you then.